G'day folks, John Williamson here, and this is Southern FM 88.3. Folks, get behind your community and your own radio station.
Welcome to the Space Show, presented at this time every week by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. And on this evening's Space Show, we focus on the smaller bodies of the solar system. Because a European Space Agency spacecraft has just zoomed past the asteroid Lutetia, and also because we have a part two of our documentary celebrating the fifth anniversary of the Deep Impact mission to Comet Tempel 2, and because NASA has a mission en route to study two asteroids. Well, first up on the Space Show, we have Space Show News. The European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft flew past an asteroid at the weekend. The probe is en route to orbit a comet. The Rosetta mission has been making a series of complex gravity assist manoeuvres, first around the Earth. That was in 2005 March, 2007 November, and 2009 November, and Mars, which was in 2007 February, plus the exciting encounters with asteroid Steins in 2008 September, and Lutetia, which was at the weekend just gone. Now, asteroid Lutetia was discovered in 1852 from the Paris balcony of a French painter-turned-astronomer Hermann Goldschmidt. Now, I bet you wouldn't find a comet these days from the balcony of a flat in the city because of light pollution, but 1852 was a different story. To honour his home city, Goldschmidt called it Lutetia, after the Roman name for Paris. It was an early vindication of Goldschmidt's career change. He became interested in astronomy after attending a talk by the great French astronomer Urbain Le Verrier of the Paris Observatory. The previous year, Le Verrier had correctly predicted the position of the then unknown planet Neptune, sparking its discovery. The mathematical success made him famous. His Paris lectures were timed to coincide with an easily visible lunar eclipse in 1847. Well, he clearly inspired Goldschmidt. Captivated by the possibilities for discovery, the painter bought a telescope, appropriately enough, with the proceeds from the sale of two portraits of Galileo. He set it up on his sixth-floor apartment's balcony and began to sweep the skies. Lutetia was his first discovery, made on the evening of 1852, November the 15th, but it was not his last discovery. During the next 9 years, he discovered 13 more asteroids, making him one of the most successful asteroid hunter of his generation. He was awarded the Gold Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1861, and he has a crater on the moon named after him. So, it was an exciting day for the scientists and mission controllers as the Rosetta spacecraft approached the mysterious asteroid Lutetia. Some of those scientists had worked on the European Space Agency's Giotto mission. For them, there was a sense of déjà vu. 18 years ago, to the very day, Giotto flew past the comet Greg Scalarup. It was a hot summer night at the European Control Centre in Darmstadt, Germany, when in 1992 Giotto slipped past the comet Greg Scalarup at a distance of just 200 kilometres. Well, Giotto was the forerunner of the European Space Agency's current Rosetta mission. Giotto had performed a spectacular flyby of Halley's Comet in 1986. It then went on to an extended mission because, although damaged by the Halley encounter, which saw dust smashing into the spacecraft at speeds of almost 70 kilometres per second, it still had 60 kilograms of fuel left on board. Well, back to the current events of Rosetta. As it held past Lutetia, Rosetta returned a series of spectacular and clear images. To the casual observer, they look like images we have seen of other asteroids or of the Martian moons Phobos or Deimos. But to the scientists who are now setting out to analyze the dozens of images, one thing is immediately obvious. The asteroid is partly metallic. The other asteroids have been imaged by spacecraft, but these have been rather stony. So what about this asteroid, Lutetia? Well, it has an aphelion, that is furthest point from the Sun, of 423.9 million kilometres. That's 2.8 times further from the Sun than what the Earth is. Its perihelion, or closest point to the Sun, is 304.6 million kilometres. That's just over twice the distance that the Earth is from the Sun. It goes around the Sun every 3.8 years. At an average orbital speed of about 18.96 kilometres per second. Its dimensions are 132 kilometres by 101 kilometres by 76 kilometres. In other words, it's not round, but is more ellipsoidal. It has a mean density of 5.55, which is about five times denser than water. The equatorial surface gravity is only 0.025 meters per second squared, which compared to Earth's gravity, which is 10 meters per second squared, or 9.8 to be more precise, you see that's very low gravity, so at 0.025 meters per second. It means that if you were standing on Lutetia, you'd only have to throw a rock or pebble or something like that upwards at 50 meters per second and it would escape. Now, if you wanted to do the same on Earth, you have to throw it at 11 kilometers per second to escape completely the Earth. That's to escape completely, not to get it into orbit. The orbital speed for the Earth is around about 8 kilometers per second. The rotation period of this asteroid is 0.34 days. That's about 8.1 hours. So it spins on its axis about every 8.1 hours. Lutetia, which by the way is asteroid number 21, is a large main belt asteroid of an unusual spectral type. It measures about 100 kilometres in diameter. As we said, it's about 130 kilometres along its major axis, and it's the largest asteroid to have been visited yet by a spacecraft. The Rosetta space probe flew by Lutetia at a minimum distance of 3,160 kilometres and a velocity of 16 kilometres per second. That's around about 54,000 kilometres per hour. It is on its way to its ultimate destination, which is the comet 67P, otherwise known as Shiryu-Mov-Gerasimenko. Data collected by Rosetta will help determine if Lutetia is a primitive undifferentiated C-type asteroid or an M-type asteroid from the core of a larger differentiated asteroid. Now, a differentiated asteroid is one which has been hot enough during its formation process for the denser materials to settle into the centre and the lighter materials to float out to the front, to the top, whereas an undifferentiated asteroid has never been hot enough for that separation to occur. Well, asteroid 253 Mathilde was the previous largest asteroid to be explored by a space probe. The composition of Lutetia has puzzled astronomers for some time, and investigation picked up in anticipation of the 2010 Rosetta flyby. Well classified among the M-type asteroids, most of which are metallic, Lutetia is one of the anomalous members that do not display much evidence of metal on their surface. Indeed, there are various indications of a non-metallic surface, a flat, low-frequency spectrum similar to that of carbonaceous chondrites and C-type asteroids, and not at all like the metallic meteorites. It has a low radar albedo, unlike the high albedos of strongly metallic asteroids like 16 Psyche. Evidence of hydrated materials on its surface. It has abundant silicates and a thick regolith, or dusty layer, thicker than most asteroids. Now, lutetia is suspected of having the high density, as we said, of around 5 grams per cubic centimetre. Light curve analysis made from the ground observations made more were made before the encounter indicates that lutetia is a rough sphere with a sharp and irregular shape features. Flyby has already inspired one European, Stuart Atkinson, to write a poem, and we'll have that poem shortly. But first up, we're going to hear now a little bit more about this from the National Geographic Society.
Asteroid 21 Lutetia is located between Jupiter and Mars, and the European Space Agency's probe Rosetta passed within about 2,000 miles of it, its onboard camera OSIRIS snapping pictures as it whizzed by.
We discovered tonight a new world. It's the largest asteroid ever seen by a human, and it's really, really exciting. It's so cool.
Though it has been observed before by ground-based telescopes, astronomers and graphic artists have imagined its shape, and no one is sure of what it's made of or its origin. The Lutetia asteroid is estimated to be about 80 miles long on its longest side. It's very old, perhaps 4.5 billion years of age, and shows signs of its wear, sporting lots of craters.
We saw really great craters of 70 kilometers size. They are like a bowl. They are so large, so huge, and they are covered. So most of them, of the larger craters, they have a very round rim, so they are very, very old craters. So it's, it's discovery. So we have a lot of large craters, tons of old craters, tons of small craters, even small craters in the large craters. So it's a lot of topography, a lot of excitement we don't understand right now, and it will keep us busy for months and years working these images.
ESA's probe made its flyby Saturday, capping a tense weekend for scientists at the agency's Darmstadt, Germany, operations center, who have guided the Rosetta spacecraft since its launch more than 6 years ago. They will spend several weeks receiving transmission of the 400 images of Lutetia it captured.
And here's another report on this wonderful flyby.
The latest stunning imagery comes from our friends over at ESA. The Rosetta spacecraft flew only 3,162 kilometers, or just under 2,000 miles, from the Lutetia asteroid on July 10, 2010. This asteroid is about 130 kilometers in diameter and is the largest asteroid ever to be visited by a spacecraft. Check out a few of the images that Rosetta took. Notice the heavily cratered surface, much like our own moon. That would come from billions of years of impacts with other objects. To put the size of this asteroid into perspective, it's about 1/13 the size of our moon at 130 kilometers as opposed to 1,737 kilometers for good old Luna. Lutetia is not the final destination for Rosetta, just a little stop along the way. In 2014, the spacecraft should rendezvous with 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, where it will not only orbit the comet, but also place a lander on its surface. Now, like many spacecraft these days, the Rosetta craft has not been without its issues, and the mission is not even done yet. Originally, the craft was to be launched in January 2003 with a rendezvous target of 46P Wirtanen in 2011. However, this plan had to be abandoned after an Ariane 5 rocket failed to launch on time. A new plan was formed to launch in February 2004 with a new target of 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. And after two more launch grubs, which we all know and love, the Rosetta spacecraft finally took flight March 2, 2004. However, this late launch date was not without consequence. On February 25, 2007, the spacecraft had to perform a low-altitude bypass of Mars to correct trajectory due to the later launch date. How low? About 250 kilometers or 155 miles. During this time, the solar panels could not be used as they would be in the shadow of Mars for 15 minutes, which forced engineers to put the craft into standby mode and hope the batteries would last. Of course, the batteries were not designed for this, and it would be a very dangerous shortage of power. This created the nickname the billion-dollar gamble for this particular maneuver. Of course, rocket scientists really do know how to gamble, and the flyby was a smashing success. Now, here's hoping Rosetta has a continued safe journey, and we get even more stunning imagery and science from that craft for years to come.
Now, this flyby has inspired one European by the name of Stuart Atkinson to write a poem, and here it is. For all these years, you were merely a smear of light through our telescopes on the clearest, coldest night. A hint of glint, just a few pixels wide, on even your most perfectly framed portraits. But now, we see you, swimming out of the dark, a great stone shark. Your star-tanned skin pitted and pocked, scarred after aeons of drifting silently through an endless ocean of space. Here on Earth, our faces lit up as we saw you clearly for the first time. Eyes wide with wonder, we traced the strangely familiar grooves raked across your sides, wondering if Rosetta had doubled back to Mars and raced past Phobos by mistake. Then you were gone, falling back into the black, not to be seen by human eyes again for a thousand blue moons or more. But we know you now. We know you. You'll never be just a speck of light again. And you... okay, here's a piece of music, and you can guess why we're playing it. It's from James Horner, and well, if I mention just two words, Deep Impact, I think you'll understand what we're on about. On last week's space show, we celebrated the fifth anniversary of the Deep Impact mission to Comet Tempel 2. This week, we have the second and concluding part in which we reveal the results. Comets are balls of ice and dust that sublime in the heat of the sun to leave long tails of gas and dust. NASA's Deep Impact mission was aimed to find out more about these mysterious objects, which can be up to 10 kilometers in diameter. One part of the spacecraft hit the comet's nucleus, boring deep into the ice. Hence the mission's name, Deep Impact, which was also a play on the Hollywood movie of the same name. The second part of the craft flew past the comet and sent back pictures and spectral data as a plume of ice shot out from the impact site. Before revealing some of the findings of this mission, we wind the clock back to 2005, July the 4th, where Kay Yee of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena was with the scientists and mission managers as Deep Impact hit Comet Tempel 2 and provided us with this commentary.
And one of the ways we can actually analyze the heights of these features is to do stereo pairs, and that'll be coming later. You can actually put the images up next to each other with stereo glasses and see just how steep some of these crater walls are. Okay, this is one of the last images sent down by the impactor just before checking out. You can see the bottom terminator, we call it. The sun is coming up from the bottom and right. And it's illuminating some extremely interesting surface features. That's going to keep the scientists going for a long time. Yeah, the navigation was perfect. It couldn't have been any better. The impact was bigger than I expected and bigger than most of us expected. So this is going to tell us a great deal about how this comet was put together, whether there was an interior pocket of gas that was released. We haven't had any information from the spectrometer, but it's not out of the question that the spectra after the impact will be completely different, or at least a bit different from pre-impact spectra, suggesting that we've released subsurface materials that we hadn't seen before. We'll be looking at that. Certainly the water production rate went up as a function of the impact, because we released interior, we excavated interior ices, and those ices are vaporized in the sunlight. So we'll be looking for just how much water production rate increased, how much the carbon dioxide gas production rate increased, how much the carbon monoxide gas rate increased. All of these gases are present in the icy form, mostly water ice, mind you, but there are more exotic ices there, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, perhaps cyanogen, we don't know. That will come out of the IR spectroscopy. Look at that resolution. It's really quite extraordinary. We're getting down to several meters resolution just prior to the impact itself. I can't imagine how this could go any better.
Well, the team has no idea what kind of surface it will find.
Well, the whole objective of the mission is to analyze the development of that crater we saw and the ejecta curtain that we saw coming off, and then ask the question, what kind of an interior cometary model would produce that type of explosive event? So by observing the crater formation process, how fast it develops, how much material is ejected from the crater, we can back down and determine just how this comet is put together. That is just prior to the... It's unlike before, that's for sure. Hard look at these images.
That was Don talking there, head of the Science Deep Impact. We're now going to hear from Charles Ilachi, who was the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, again in conversation with Kay Yee.
Well, we are about a half hour out after the impact. It has been a good day here at the Jet Propulsion Lab. And with me right now is the director here, Dr. Charles Ilachi. Your reaction, your feelings. I remember there was some tension there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we are absolutely ecstatic. You know, from the beginning, I said this is one of the most daring and risky missions that JPL ever undertook. And here we are. We have successful. You know, and the impact is all successful. And all we fight about.
You talked about that this was so difficult and daring because there were no footsteps ahead of us. There was no guidebook to teach us how to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the first time we were doing this this kind of a mission. And when you are doing something for the first time and there is no trail and no footstep ahead of you, that's what we're about. You know, at NASA and at JPL is to actually blaze new trails. And tonight we have put a new trail and for other people to follow after us. We're already thinking about the next step of what we'll be doing while the scientists are doing the analysis of this data.
You talked about that there were no footsteps ahead of us.
So we're really in the business of opening new frontiers.
We need to maintain discipline here. We're still trying to run some operations.
All right. We're being told that the mission has to quit celebrating for a while and get back to their job.
Yeah. We still have a flyby spacecraft which is flying and collecting data, so we have to stay keep people focused on that activity.
But one of the things you mentioned to the reporters at the news conference this morning was, tomorrow morning, new people come here, it's going to change the way you see the solar system.
Absolutely. Tomorrow morning, as we analyze this data, matter of fact, as of now, I think we have a completely different understanding of our solar system. So every step we take, it gives us new insight in how the solar system formed. Hopefully, in this case, a number of people believe that the comet actually brought water to Earth, which led to life. So this is going to give us a whole new insight as we analyze all that data, and the success exceeded our expectations.
And what's up ahead? More comet missions?
Absolutely. I mean, the plan, number one, this mission, we still have to analyze all the data acquired from it. There are plans for, remember, we have Stardust, which is coming back with samples. So in January, we'll have actually samples from the coma and the tail of the comet. In a few years from now, our colleagues in Europe are going to have a spacecraft Rosetta, which would land a lander on a comet, and we're already planning for possibilities in the future of bringing samples back from the nucleus of a comet.
So was it worth it?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was worth every cent that we have spent on it, the insight that we're going to get.
And all the stress and anxiety and
well, that comes with the job. Yeah, I mean, in this business, you have to, I mean, even that we're, you know, anxious, but also people were calm and focused. As you saw, everybody in the mission operation room, they were just focused on getting their job done.
All right. Dr. Charles Alachi, thanks for joining us. It was a big risk. There was lots of tension here, but it all paid off.
And Kay was talking there, she said, to Charles Alachi, the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Well, we're now going to go back with Kay, and we're going to see what happened as the impactor hit the asteroid and went crashing, you know, as we get into it. And we're going to listen to some of the Capcoms, and we're going to have Don Yeomans back with us again. Now, remember, Don Yeomans is the head of the science team for the Deep Impact mission.
Flight, this is Flight Thermal.
Go ahead, Thermal.
This is Mission Control. We're now coming up on look back. Hang on a sec.
Mid-170s. I've got external thruster brackets at about 32C, and they appear to be cooling.
We're getting the team reporting out. We're about to come out of shield mode and we'll be down, then starting to our playback of all our images. And we've had the fault protection engineer report in that we're restoring our fault protection to our cruise mode. We're coming out of the critical mode that we were in for encounter. On our spacecraft, we have a software that we have that we call fault protection software. And this is software that reacts to problems on board the spacecraft, which it has to handle autonomously because, one, we're not always in contact with the spacecraft. There are times in cruise when we don't have a station, a DSM, and so we can't interact right away. And so fault protection has to deal with the situation for us. And then, of course, in an encounter, things are happening so quickly that we have to have fault protection there to react again. In that case, you know, events happen faster than the one-way light time that went, and here we had a one-way light time of about 7 minutes. So at this point, we're coming out of the critical fault protection mode and going back into our cruise mode, which is less rigorous, but nevertheless needed.
I got it.
Oh, we're seeing another great image here of the impact. These are the pictures that are coming in now from the flyby, the post impact images, and this one's pretty cool. It's a huge display of ejecta coming out, I think much more so than people anticipated. That's really neat.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time? 063147 should be loss of lock going to 10 bits per second.
Copy, thank you.
Mission, this is flyby fault protect.
And we have Don Yeomans with the science team back with us now here in Mission Control. Don, look at that image.
This is an image from the science team wall with a young lady's head on the lower left.
That's right, we're looking at right off the screen as projected.
But that was the last full frame image from the MRI flyby camp. The flyby spacecraft 13 minutes after the impact takes the last full frame, which is what you're seeing here, and then it goes into what we call shield mode so that it protects the flyby telescope optics from the dust particles that are most dense near the cometary nucleus. So it goes into the shield mode for about a half an hour, and then it'll turn around and look back at the comet, but it'll be a long way away at that point. So this is the image that the planetary scientists are going to study, along with several more, just before and after, and try and understand just what we did to this comet. It's considerably more than I thought would happen. A couple of scientists thought that perhaps we would impact the comet and release some subsurface pockets of gas. This is one of the MRI images just prior to going into shield mode, as we talked about. This one's not nearly as spectacular as the last one, but it does show the impact. The crater itself will take about 2 minutes to slow motion, not like here on the Earth. Because of the reduced gravity of the comet, everything happens in slow motion. So this crater actually develops, gets larger and larger. But that's the ejecta, most of it's coming up and leaving. And then having done that, you can actually look at that interior material now on the surface
and do some spectral analysis to try and understand just what is the composition of that material.
I assume because this is so spectacular.
That's a good point. I'm sure the ground-based telescopes must have seen an enhancement in the light. They must have seen an enhancement in some of the spectral composition measurements they're making. What they do is they look for fingerprints of, mm-hmm. of specific molecules. For example, water, carbon dioxide has another that can be identified, and the same way with carbon monoxide, and then a raft of other more exotic species. And so these folks are going to be looking for those exotic species. Well, we're still looking at the flyby spacecraft is showing us the impact, and as it was designed to do, that was the whole point, is to have the flyby spacecraft fly under the comet and look autonomously at the same location that the impactor strikes. So not only do these spacecraft have to hit the comet, the first one, but the flyby spacecraft has to know, independent of the impactor, just where the impactor was going to hit, and that seems to have worked perfectly as well. So it's not just running into a comet with the impactor, but you have to have the flyby spacecraft know where to look and image the impact itself. And that seems to have worked beautifully, as has almost everything on this mission. It's been a smashing success, but it certainly has that. And this is just a tiny fraction of the images. We're only sending back tonight some of the critical images, as they're called. There's a vast number of images that will be coming back in the 12 hours following the shield mode, which indeed follows the impact. So this is just a small sample of the images we're going to get and be able to analyze in the coming days.
Do you know if we will be able to see any of the cratering type images tonight?
Well, we're seeing
the ejecta.
The number of images that were actually sent down in what we call real time, as they happen, was relatively few. Most of the images have been stored on the flyby spacecraft and will be played down at 200 kilobits a second to the Earth over the next 12 hours. Now, 200 kilobits a second is not much more than a phone modem can do. So, I mean, we're 83 million miles away. Jeez, look at that. It looks like an illustration. I'm at a loss to explain just how on Earth a little washing machine size impactor caused such a disturbance some 83 million miles away. This is going to take some work to explain this, but it's certainly taken me by surprise, and I suspect some of my colleagues up in the science area are all equally surprised.
There was a bit of applause here in Mission Control. I believe I heard Dave Spencer's voice, the mission manager, thanking the team and all the hard work. It truly paid off.
A lot of these folks from Ball Aerospace worked night and day to make this happen. They built the spacecraft and some of the instruments. University of Maryland, of course, Mike Ahern was the principal investigator. They were instrumental in making this a success. The JPL navigators did another miraculous job from a number of different universities throughout the country and the world, came together, and the team worked as one, and by golly, we pulled it off.
Don, what's next in terms of the analysis of these particular images? What will the science team be doing with them?
Well, as the images come down in the next 12 or 24 hours, they'll be changed from the raw data that we saw tonight. They're a little bit rough.
Which is hard to believe that these images are considered rough, and that what we're going to see is much, much better than what we've seen tonight.
That's a good point. These are indeed raw images. They haven't been processed. They haven't been smoothed. The dark levels haven't been adjusted. So you're actually seeing the raw data, and these pictures are going to get a lot better, and we're going to get a lot more of them. So this is going to keep the planetary science community happy for quite a while.
All right. Well.
And that was Kay Yee with Don Yeoman's head science team at Deep Impact Mission. And that was on 2005, July the 4th, at 5:52 Universal Time is when that impact occurred. Well, as they said, the data took a fair while to come down, the few quick pictures, just in the same way as the Rosetta spacecraft is still relaying back pictures that it took at the Lutetia asteroid at the weekend. Now, what did it find out? We're 5 years on. We've had time to analyse the data. Well, it turns out that dust released by the impact was clearly seen by the Gemini telescope at Mauna Kea in Hawaii. The dust ejected into the comet's coma by the impact was a mixture of grains with a composition of amorphous carbon, amorphous pyroxene, amorphous olivine, and magnesium-rich crystalline olivine. The most common grain size was 0.3 of a millimeter. An hour after the impact, somewhere between 73 and 1,500 tons of material was seen moving away from the comet. The speed of the silicate grains were over 130 meters per second. It took more than a day for this ejected material to disperse to undetectable levels. The impact did not trigger an ongoing eruption in the comet. The observations of the dust composition have suggested two formation theories for Comet Temple 2. The first theory is that the comet formed in the same area of the solar nebula as that of the Oort cloud comets. Unlike most Oort comets, it was not ejected from the inner regions of the solar system out of the Oort, so into the inner regions of the solar system out of the Oort cloud. It is suggested that as many as a third of all comets formed in the region between Jupiter and Neptune did not get scattered out into the Oort cloud. The second theory suggests that the solar nebula was very homogeneous, even by the time of icy planetesimal formation. The crystalline silicates would have been formed early in the history of the solar nebula, but were then transported out to the large radii to be incorporated into comets. So there we have it, a very exciting time in the inner solar system here on the Space Show. On this evening's Space Show, we're concentrating on the smaller bodies of the solar system.
From the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, I'm Elaine Marconi. The Dawn spacecraft is about to embark on a journey to study a pair of asteroids. Why study asteroids, and what will this mission accomplish? Principal investigator for the Dawn mission, Chris Russell, is here with us now to give us some insight. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Tell us about the asteroid belt, and specifically these two planetoids.
There's many ways to describe the asteroid belt. One of the important ways is it's a repository of the historical record of the solar system. In that region are the earliest bodies that were formed when the solar system formed. Some of them, these bodies, have been relatively unscathed, and some of them grew to fairly large, significant sizes. And we have a chance now to go out with the Dawn mission and to look at these variety of bodies and to learn more about the earliest epoch of the solar system.
What are you going to learn about Ceres and Vesta that you don't already know?
Well, we know very little about these two bodies at the present time. All we have are telescopic observations, and even with our best telescope, with the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, we cannot resolve very well the features on the surface. We can tell that there's features on the surface. They may be craters, they may be mountains, they may just be coloration changes across the surface. But they're teasing us. They're teasing us to go out there and explore them with our high-resolution cameras.
How are the two asteroids like other planets in the solar system?
The two asteroids are very different from each other, amazingly, even though they're fairly close. But one of them is very similar to our moon, and the other is very similar to the moons of Jupiter. The first body, Vesta, closest to the sun of the two, has basaltic flows on the surface. That's lava flows that came out very early in its history. And we can tell that from the reflected light that we see back on Earth. If you shine a light, or say sunlight, on lava flow on Earth, and you shine a sunlight on Vesta, you get a very similar spectrum or color of the light. The Ceres is a much darker object, and when we use the few bits of information we have, like how massive it is and the size it is and its shape, we infer that it has lots of water in it. And the moons of Jupiter and also many of the moons of Saturn are also water ice rich. And so we have a representative, it seems, of the inner solar system in the asteroid belt and a representative of the outer solar system. And they are now close enough in the sky that one spacecraft can explore the first and leave after exploring it and go to the second and explore the second, which is just a marvelous opportunity for us.
Will these studies help us understand near-Earth objects? Is that the goal of the flight?
The goal of the flight is not to learn more about the near-Earth asteroids themselves. However, we get new information about the formation of the asteroid belt as a whole, and that should help us understand the near-Earth objects, which are, in general, remnants of collisions and scattering of particles from further on out. So we're operating in the heart of the asteroid belt. The near-Earth objects are at the edge, but we believe that the near-Earth objects are, in fact, representative of just scattered objects out of the heart of the radiation, out of the asteroid belt.
How are Ceres and Vesta different from each other?
The first difference of Vesta and Ceres is their size. Vesta is a little more than one-half the size of Ceres. In diameter, it's about 330 miles, whereas Ceres is almost twice that, a little over 600 miles across. They're also different in their density, that Vesta is about the density of Mars, somewhere around 4 grams in every cubic centimeter, and that Ceres is much less dense, about half that value. In order to be so much less dense, if it has as much rock as it should have as much rock in it roughly as Vesta, then it must have some lighter constituent, and the most obvious constituent that it would have is water. And so if we calculate how much water it would take to make Ceres the observed density, we get an outer layer of water, or possibly water ice, of about 100 kilometers, or about 60 miles thick crust of ice. So one we think is an icy body, perhaps covered with dust or clay, and one is a rocky body, very similar to our moon, but smaller.
What's been the hardest part about getting the mission started?
Well, I think it's the aging process. We started back in 1992 at a discovery workshop where an engineer from the NASA Lewis Center, now NASA Glenn, told us about ion engines and what ion engines could do. It did not take me long to realize that the ion engine was a way of doing something that I had always wanted to do, and that is to reuse instruments that we might use to explore the surface of one body on another body. Instead of building two missions, we would save money by building one mission and exploring two objects. My first idea was to explore the moon and then go to explore a dormant comet. And I proposed that in 1994. It was pretty ambitious, and at that time, NASA was a little shy of starting off this program with a very ambitious program, a very ambitious mission. So we didn't get selected. What did get selected was a lunar mission and a comet, basically a cometary mission, which went out to collect interplanetary dust and bring it back. So we decided next that we loved the idea, but we needed to change the objects that we were studying. So the The first proposal had the moon in it, and the most moon-like asteroid is Vesta. And so we decided to go to Vesta. And to continue the study in the way I had envisioned it, we also decided to go to two smaller asteroids, minor planets, you might say, and we picked Glassinopia and also Lutetia. These are much smaller, although they're important size, but even though that this was, again, daring and the next step that we should be taking in space, it did not get selected. The next time we had an opportunity to propose was 1998, and this was the time when Deep Space One was being launched. And the purpose of Deep Space One, I guess they've been reading my proposals for years, and finally test these ion engines. So they took the ion engines and were going to put them on a spacecraft that would test them out, and then they could become a workhorse for the planetary program. When my proposal went in, and this time Vesta and one other asteroid, I believe it was Glassinopia again, when the proposal went in and got to the evaluation committee, it was just about the time that they tried to fire the engines on Deep Space One, and the engines didn't fire properly. They stopped thrusting, and it took them a few weeks to get them thrusting again. Eventually, the engine started thrusting, and everybody was happy. However, NASA was still a little edgy about selecting, putting their money behind an ion propulsion mission. Now, but, you know, time was on my side. I was still young. And so I reproposed again in the year 2000. This time, nature was helping out because Vesta and Ceres had got closer together. And once they get close enough together in the sky, then a spacecraft can go from one to the other fairly easily. Now, Vesta and Ceres have different orbits, and it takes Vesta 17 years before it can lap Ceres and catch up with it again. So that we call that the synodic period, the period which it takes one object to initially be lined up, say, with the sun, and then go around and get lined up again. And so this position for going from one to the other, that relative position in the sky, only happens every 17 years. But I was fortunate enough to be around when it happened in writing a proposal. And so we sent in the proposal and we said, we can do both Vesta and Ceres. Nobody else had thought of that. The competition said, oh, we would like to do Vesta, but nobody said we'd like to do Vesta and Ceres and made the case for it. And at that point, we were selected. And as I say, the rest is history. We put the mission together, and now it's sitting on the pad, all stacked up and ready to go. It just needs to have the fuel tanker come over and pour whatever it does into those rockets.
What made you want to work on this mission?
Well, when I was very young, which seems only just yesterday, I worked on the Apollo program, and I got very interested in the moon, the physics of the moon, the interior of the moon, the surface of the moon, and how the moon was made. And I initially, when we started this, as I mentioned, I was interested in finishing up our exploration of the moon. I used this mission to do things that we had not finished doing on the Apollo program. When that opportunity was taken away from me, in a figurative sense, by selecting the Lunar Prospector mission, I thought that was a good thing to do, but I would have preferred to do it myself. But I still had the same objective in mind, to learn about other bodies that were similar, and the Vesta was the most analogous body to the moon. And then what I was looking for in the series of proposals that I wrote were complementary bodies that would contrast with Vesta and teach us more by that contrast. We learn a lot in life by taking two objects and comparing them, like an apple and an orange. You could study an apple forever but not really realize what makes an apple a fruit. If you compare with an orange, you say, well, an orange is a fruit and an apple is a fruit, what's in common? And then you learn more about the generic class of objects that you're studying. And that's what we're trying to do now. We're not trying to tell oranges from apples. We're trying to find out why the oranges and apples are alike.
How is the Dawn mission different from previous flights through the asteroid belt?
Well, there are lots of ways. Most of the missions through the asteroid belts have not very much time. They've been heading someplace else, like Galileo heading off to Jupiter and Cassini heading off to Saturn. They looked at asteroids on the form block of rock, and we didn't learn very much about the formation of the solar system. We understood a little more about what near-Earth objects are like, but we didn't get we weren't able to really travel backward in time very far with that particular investigation. So what we're trying to do is to go out to the heart of the asteroid belt to orbit these bodies, not just fly by like Galileo and Cassini, and really do a detailed, in-depth investigation of them. And again, we're using one set of instruments, one spacecraft, and two extraterrestrial bodies.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
For more on the Dawn mission, visit nasa.gov. I'm Elaine Marconi.
And our thanks to Elaine for that report. And she recorded that conversation with Chris Russell just before the launch, and that launch happened on September the 27th of 2007. And the latest report from the mission is that it's now well on its way. The thrusters are working well, and the new software has just been installed a few days ago into the main computer. So well on the way there. Classic Rock.